The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Industry in Israel. And what it does is it repackages occupation-style repression for use on other marginalized populations in other parts of the world. And Israeli weapons manufacturers end up marketing their products as, you know, combat tested and battle proven. And these are coveted labels in the international arms trade that give, you know, companies like Israeli companies a massive competitive edge in that arena. And this arrangement has been especially lucrative for Israel in the post 9/11 era. Israel has really like kind of branded itself as this expert, you know, in counterterrorism that's been fighting, you know, it's always portrayed the conflict with Palestinians for decades. You know, Netanyahu in particular, like for, you know, decades ago was talking about, you know, the dark forces of militant Islam, you know, which is something he still says often. Portraying this as a conflict of a clash of civilizations and a conflict of, you know, enlightened Israel fighting these hostile hordes of terrorists. This really never caught on until after 9/11. And since 2002, since Israel sort of positioned itself as the expert in counterterrorism for, you know, Europe and the U.S. to come to for guidance, the, you know, Israeli arms sales have risen from $2 billion to $7 billion annually, which has paved the way for Israel, which is like this tiny, tiny country that's barely the size of New Jersey, to rank among the top 10 and sometimes top 5 arms exporters in the world. And, you know, Israeli arms sales are increasingly going to countries, you know, developing countries in Latin America, in Africa, and there's reasons for that, which I'll go into a little bit later. But I do want to point out, though, that this sort of laboratory dynamic that exists between Israel and Palestine, it's not the reason Israel does what it does. This is just a symptom, right? It's a symptom of Israel being a settler colonial state. Let's remember, you know, its creation was precipitated by this premeditated campaign of mass expulsion and ethnic cleansing of 750,000 indigenous Palestinians by Zionist militias in 1947 and 1948, which Palestinians call the Nakba. And Israel spent every single day since then working to consolidate its demographically engineered Jewish majority in the state that it, you know, it wants to maintain a Jewish majority and it's historically not majority Jewish. So that's why millions of Palestinians scattered throughout refugee camps in the Middle East till this day are prevented from returning to their ancestral lands because they pose this demographic threat. They pose this threat. They would upend this Jewish majority that Israel has worked very, very hard to maintain. Now, Israel's continued existence and expansion as a Jewish majority state requires massive amounts of violence because Palestinians still exist, right, in the millions. So it requires this ongoing removal and containment and system of warehousing of the remaining native inhabitants in, you know, historic Palestine. And that's what Zionism looks like in practice. And Israel's economy has been built around advancing this goal, right? It's around catering to the designs of Zionism. It's been shaped by this. So that's why it's at the cutting edge of what you call repression technology, because it's constantly having to, you know, come up with these new innovative methods for controlling people. And that's why Israel has the highest concentration of homeland security companies in the world. When they call themselves a startup nation, this is what they are talking about. Yes, they are really great at high tech, but the vast majority of their high tech, you know, is about controlling people. And so with Palestine as its laboratory, Israel is basically producing these tools that are now helping sustain racism and inequality around the world, and particularly in the form of like warehousing people and pacifying people. Now, what does this have to do with Ferguson, right? And these uprisings that are taking place across the country in places like Ferguson and Baltimore? Well, you know, I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of the resistance that we're seeing in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and across the country, and also in places like Palestine, is resistance to this idea that, you know, a particular group of people have been deemed disposable. They've been deemed like surplus humanity in many ways. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, surplus humanity, what does that mean? It's basically populations who have been categorized as, you know, superfluous. In the case of the US, because capitalism no longer has a use for them. They've sort of been thrown away by the economy. The majority of people who fall under this category live in the global south, which serves as this source of cheap labor and resource extraction and a place to dump, you know, all our cheap commodities for essentially captive markets. And in many ways, Israel-Palestine is like a microcosm of this, of the system. Israel steals land and resources from Palestinians and, uses them, to a far lesser extent than it used to, but as a source of cheap labor, and forces them to be dependent on Israeli goods. And, in recent years, Israel no longer even needs their labor, nor does it want their labor. They've been replaced by, foreign labor from places like the Philippines and West Africa. So Palestinians, in a lot of ways, and African Americans in this country, are sort of like the clearest embodiments of surplus humanity. And in terms of Palestinians, they're not Jewish. Israel doesn't want them. It's the 21st century, so Israel can't just like expel them all at once. It can't just wipe them all out. That's no longer acceptable to do. So Israel warehouses them. They warehouse people that Israeli American scholar Martin Kramer from Harvard has labeled economically superfluous young men. It's warehoused them inside walled off ghettos, with Gaza being the most severe version of that. In Gaza, Israel's really pioneered the world's most sophisticated and high-tech human warehousing model. And I'll go back to that. But, Israel's really mastered this art of warehousing those deemed disposable, and it's perfected the language to justify it. The people being warehoused are terrorists. Separation walls are built for security. Israel's not crushing a political movement seeking self-determination. It's battling death-worshipping terrorists in a clash of civilizations between the enlightened whiter West, which is represented by Israel, and the darker-skinned, forces of Islamic terrorism. And Israel's had 48 years of experience applying this logic to millions of captive Palestinians. In this post-9/11 era of hyper-disaster capitalism, it's a time when, advancements in technology are making human labor in many sectors obsolete. Global elites are turning to Israel for guidance in pacifying and warehousing these growing weight ranks of surplus humanity. Now, bringing it back to the U.S., and the way Black people are treated in this country, I'm always reminded of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. She talks about how, unlike during, slavery and Jim Crow, which was a period more of like exploiting Black labor, whether it's using them as slaves or, the Jim Crow era, mass incarceration is designed to warehouse this population that's been deemed disposable. It's being deemed, as Michelle Alexander says, unnecessary to the functioning of the new global economy, while earlier systems of control were designed to exploit and control Black labor. So that's why, as Michelle Alexander has noted and sort of popularized this idea, more African American adults are under correctional control today in prison or in jail on probation or parole than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. So this rise of the war on drugs really coincided with the collapse of inner city economies, due in large part to deindustrialization and globalization and these advancements in technology that replaced certain kinds of labor, to the point where the American economy decided it no longer needed had any use for Black labor. So Blackness and poverty were severely criminalized through the war on drugs. Prisons are the most obvious form of warehousing, right? Because they're prisons. But then there's also ghettos. There's jobless ghettos in this country. Baltimore, I would call, parts of Baltimore that I visited after Freddie Gray was murdered, I would call those jobless ghettos. Most of the young men I spoke to, their biggest issue after the issue of police violence was like, I can't get a job. There's no job. The only job I can get maybe is like a minimum wage job. I'm not making enough to feed my family. Also, I have a record because, you have to use the illicit economy when there's no jobs for anyone. So these people are just locked out. They've literally just been abandoned by the state and deemed disposable, and they're sort of trapped in these jobless ghettos that nobody ever visits or wants to be near. So what we see today, though, this has been taking place for a while, right? This is obviously not Israel's fault. My point is to just sort of make a parallel here between the way that people who have been deemed disposable are treated by the state and how Israel has really pioneered a new model for a way to do this more efficiently. And while police have sort of always been an occupying force in poor Black neighborhoods in this country, what we see today is this convergence of the war on terror with the war on drugs and the way police behave in Black communities, particularly if residents attempt to resist their conditions, like we've seen in Ferguson and Baltimore. Which, by the way, I would like to note that I do find it very interesting that the burning of a CVS or of a Quick Trip elicits a response that looks like martial law from the state, while the burning down of black churches across the South seems to elicit nothing but silence and excuses. I mean, it's a pretend ISIS flag at a gay pride parade covered in dildos. Alarmed CNN, I think, more than the burning of black churches in the South. And that's a very, I mean, that's as funny as that is, that's really, I mean, that's kind of striking and just shows you how little it matters. But anyways, so as I was saying, there's these parallels between the way that disposable populations are being treated. And the place that Israel comes in is in sort of guiding in these new methods that are very related to the war on terror and militarization and how to more efficiently control and warehouse populations. And so where I want to take it from there is the fact that, under the cover of counterterrorism training, nearly every single police agency in the US, from the FBI to DHS to like police agencies in places in like Massachusetts that, you know, are tiny, have gone on these trips to Israel, have sent their senior officials on trips to Israel for lessons in occupation enforcement and crowd control and media spin and Islamic fundamentalism. The Israeli security apparatus and US police departments are so entangled with one another that the New York City Police Department has an office in Israel. The NYPD's demographics unit, which spied on Muslims, it's been shut down since de Blasio came into office, but for a while it was spying on Muslims, that was modeled in large part on how Israel operates in the West Bank. So close ties between US police departments and the Israeli security apparatus are being forged by an assortment of Israel lobbying organizations. One of the main ones is the Anti-Defamation League, which you may know as an organization that has a history of spying on Americans and produces annual blacklists of organizations and people critical of Israel, calling them anti-Semites. The ADL boasts of sending more than 175 senior US law enforcement officials from 100 different agencies to its National Counterterrorism Seminar. This is an annual week-long Israeli training camp where US law enforcement executives, quote, study firsthand Israel's tactics and strategies directly from senior commanders in the Israeli National Police, experts from Israel's intelligence and security services, and the Israel Defense Forces. The attendees are taking lessons they learned in Israel back to the United States. The other main organization that does these trips is called JINSA. It's this neoconservative think tank that operates out of Washington, D.C. And JINSA has hosted some 9,500 law enforcement officials in the U.S. in its law enforcement exchange program since 2004, which basically brings U.S. and Israeli security people together to learn from one another and then takes, you know, officials, U.S. officials to Israel to tour the West Bank and tour checkpoints and, you know, see how Israel, you know, occupies Palestine. So, you know, I just want to give you like a couple ideas of the way that police respond to these trips. The former U.S. Capitol Police Chief, Terrence Ganger, called Israel the Harvard of anti-terrorism after returning from one of these trips. And he actually applied some of the stuff he learned in Jerusalem to the D.C. Police Department that's still in effect today. One of these things is keeping their lights, their siren lights on at all times. I mean, this is typically only in the, like, in parts of D.C. that are, you know, poor and black that you see this, but just all night long, all day long, you always keep your sirens on. It's just a way to just keep people in fear. The police are always here and watching, right? No experience in my life has had more of an impact on doing my job than going to Israel. That's the chief of the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. Recently, the chief of the Fresno, California Police Department, Jerry Dyer, he went to visit Israel-Palestine in November of last year, and after observing the Gaza border, he said, I picked up a few ideas on things we could do with our system that they currently do. And you know, the list goes on and on. This is what police chiefs and senior commanders say after returning. They love what they see. They want to apply it at home. And I will note, since we're in Chicago, back in November, the Chicago Police Department superintendent, Gary McCarthy, He attended Israel's third annual Homeland Security Conference, and he took a delegation of his own officers to tour Israel and how they do policing. And he said, he called this an opportunity to, quote, learn from our Israeli partners on ways to better serve and protect our own community. Now, it's difficult to know exactly what is being learned on these trips because there's so little examination of them. This issue is virtually ignored, especially in the US media. No one wants to touch it. Even though it's really alarming that you've got police departments in this country traveling to Israel regularly, learning from an occupying force that's invested or daily is involved in committing, you know, human rights abuses and war crimes. And also with Ferguson and Baltimore, I will note the police departments that were active there, especially in crushing the protests, were, I looked into like every single, almost every single one of them had, you know, had sent senior level commanders to Israel on trips there. And I will say also this, that in Baltimore, almost, I saw police departments from all over, like all over the area, from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. I've never seen so many outside agitators in one place in my life. Now the point isn't that, you know, Israel's responsible for the way police behave in this country. There's a long history since, you know, the inception of American policing, of, you know, serious racism and violence, towards, marginalized communities, particularly the Black community. However, it's something that should not be ignored. And you know, one way that I noticed that it's important that people are making the connection between what Israel's doing, what police are doing here, and how they learn from each other, is the response to Palestinians and Black people in this country resisting police violence, making connections and being in solidarity with one another and working together. The response to it has been one of like alarm. You've got the ADL making lists of anybody, whether they're Black or Palestinian, of making these connections between U.S. police departments in Israel and calling them anti-Semites. You know, you've got in Ferguson there was a museum talk that was shut down because it was about Black Lives Matter, but it included Palestinians and was going to talk about the Palestinian issue. So you know, people are scared about the possibility. You know, of when the oppressed start to work together, because they realize their oppressors are working together, people get nervous. People in power get nervous, and that's what I see happening here. Now I wanna move on a little bit to Gaza, because most of the stuff that US police are learning is what they're seeing happen in the West Bank. Gaza's different. Gaza is this more severe version of the laboratory dynamic I talked about, and also this warehousing dynamic. The Gaza Strip has basically been transformed by Israel into this open air testing ground for weapons of mass destruction. Gaza is this cage for racial outcasts, right, that Israel's deemed disposable and unworthy of basic rights, and I would say even more so than Palestinians in the West Bank. 80% of the people who live in Gaza are refugees or the descendants of refugees whose families were forced out of present-day Israel. And they're banned from ever returning for one reason only, it's because they're not Jewish. And unlike the West Bank, which has been completely pacified for the most part, the people of Gaza have not been disarmed or pacified. They continue to resist Israel's settler colonial ambitions, and they do it with arms. And so Israel punishes them for their refusal to submit. And that's why Israel's de-developed Gaza and isolated from the world with a land, air, and sea blockade. That's why Israel has transformed Gaza into this giant ghetto surrounded by electrified fences and surveillance drones and remote-controlled machine guns and Navy gunboats. And that's why Gaza is subjected to periodic massacres, each one more brutal than the last. It's all to break the people's will to resist and to keep them contained and basically to manage them. And in the process, Gaza's become this playground for Israel's arms companies to test their products, especially companies that produce drone technology. And we saw this play out last summer during Operation Protective Edge, as Israel calls it. Which was the 51-day bombing campaign that left 2,251 Palestinians dead and injured another 11,000. Vast majority of the people that were killed were civilians. 551 of them were children. And Gaza was, we now know from a recent report, was the third most dangerous place in the world to be a civilian last year because of the sheer amount of explosives Israel dropped on it. Now, less than a month after that horrific slaughter, Israel held its annual drone conference, which was organized in partnership with the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. And they basically gave all these Israeli military firms an opportunity to showcase their products to international buyers. And many of these products were debuted and tested, like, debuted and used for the first time in Gaza. So as Gaza was buried under 4 million tons of rubble, you had the death merchants responsible parading around this drone conference bragging about their successes. And the editor of Israel Defense Magazine, which is this defense industry publication that actually hosted the conference during the war, had this to say. This was like a few weeks prior to the conference. He said, "The war is an opportunity to cut red tape. Weapon systems that have long been under development suddenly became operational during the course of fighting." Now, I mentioned drones because, and I say this and I mean it, I don't mean like, Israel says it invented lots of things. It says it invented hummus, right? That's a lie. So I just want you to understand, I actually mean this when I say it. Israel invented drones. Only three countries in the world are known to have used armed drones, and that's America and the UK and Israel. All of which share a very common bond of being settler colonial states, but that's beside the point. So Israel, of these three countries, Israel has supplied the most drones around the world. It's supplied 60% of the world's drones since 1985, which makes it the single greatest source of drone proliferation across the globe. What most people don't know is that Israel was instrumental in pioneering the modern drone. After suffering heavy losses in the 1973 war with Egypt, and then again in 1982 in Lebanon, for the first time in its existence, really, the Israeli government had to deal with this backlash from the Israeli Jewish public unaccustomed to soldier casualties, especially mothers. There was like a group of mothers that protested and didn't want their sons being killed anymore in these wars. So it was after this that Israel invested heavily, as the Israeli government started investing heavily in drone technology, in robotic warfare, in an effort to minimize the risk to soldiers and in a way, pacify any future opposition to this endless war and expansion. And the expansion of remote-controlled weapons has basically, since then, allowed for the sustainability of Israel's occupation and its perpetual conflict with its neighbors. And Palestinians and people in Lebanon have been the guinea pigs for this warfare, for this robotic warfare that's basically swept the world. In last summer in Gaza, 37% of the people who were killed died in drone strikes alone. I mean, it was a very robotic war. That's kind of unprecedented for a war like that to be fought with so much robotic technology. So Israel really is the pioneer here. And Israel has exported technology that's been tested on Palestinians to at least 50 countries around the world. It's even sold drones in some cases to both sides in a given conflict. That was the case with Russia and Georgia. It's also sold drones to Turkey and the Kurdistan Workers Party, which have used them against each other. It's also, with permission from the United States, it's sold drones to Sri Lanka, which were used to commit atrocities against in Sri Lanka's war against the ethnic Tamil minority. Its drone exports to India fueled this arms race between India and Pakistan for drones. There's really too many to name, but Israel's drones are everywhere, all across the world. And its premier drone maker, Elbit Systems, which is the largest developer of military technology, is sort of one of my favorite to profile because it's this massive company that really sort of represents how Israeli companies function across the world. Elbit supplies 85% of the drones the Israeli military uses, but 75% of Elbit's market is outside of Israel. So it basically is testing its technology on Palestinians and then packaging it as combat-proven and battle-tested and selling it around the world. And it's grown. It's become this massive company because of it. And during the war in Gaza last summer, Elbit's stock actually rose to the highest it had been in years because this was attributed to investors who were predicting that there would be an increased demand in Elbit's products because of what they were seeing in Gaza. One of these drones is called, it's one of the only ones I'll reference, but one of these drones is called the Hermes 450. It's Elbit's most widely used drone by the Israeli army, particularly in Gaza. This drone documented by human rights organizations to have been used to deliberately target civilians in Gaza in 2008, 2009, during Caslet, and in Lebanon in 2006 as well. This is a drone that's been purchased by the Brazilian government. And last summer, this drone and a fleet of Elbit drones actually helped crush these massive protests that erupted across Brazil against the World Cup last summer. I mean, Dave Zirin, who's in the audience, wrote about this. He talked about the Gazification of what he saw in Brazil. And that largely had to do with the drone use and some of the methods that the Brazilian police were using to, you know, clear the slums in the lead up to this. Thales UK, which is the subsidiary of the French company Thales, which is it's ranked as the 11th largest arms producer in the world, is a part of this $1.6 billion joint venture with Elbit Systems to develop a new drone fleet for the UK military called Watchkeeper. This Watchkeeper fleet is modeled off of the Hermes 450 drone that Elbit used and, you know, pioneered and tested in Gaza. And that, you know, that fleet has already been sent at least a couple times to Afghanistan. So this is kind of the way that also Elbit has another drone called the Hermes 900, which is a larger version of this 450. And that drone was quote unquote field tested for the first time last summer during Gaza. And it was described by the Israeli military as the star of protective edge. And since then it's been sold to other countries as well. So this is sort of like the way it works. The Gaza wars act as these sort of advertisements. In the case of last summer, it was like a 51-day long advertisement for Israel's weapons industry. And also, Israel's products, from Elbit especially, are being used at the border with U.S.-Mexico border. So there's just also this relationship between what's happening with immigration control and learning from Israel and using some of its methods. Elbit Systems got a $145 million contract from the Department of Homeland Security to build this virtual wall of surveillance towers and motion detectors at the Arizona-Mexico border to keep migrants out. This is the same Elbit technology that was used to construct and maintain Israel's apartheid wall in the occupied West Bank, which has been deemed a violation of international law by the International Court of Justice. Not that that matters, because Israel can apparently do whatever it wants. But the purpose of the apartheid wall in Israel, in Palestine, according to Netanyahu, and I'm quoting him, is to, quote, prevent demographic spillover of Palestinians. What that means is the purpose of the wall is to keep Palestinians from contaminating Israel's Jewish purity. I mean, that's what that means. So if you think about it, what Elbit and other Israeli border security companies are helping the U.S. do at the Mexico border is to prevent demographic spillover, right, of like poor Latinos who are trying to come into the U.S. and poor Mexicans. And Israeli companies like Elbit, like NICE Systems, that's another one, it works in like surveillance technology and data mining, and another company called Aeronautics Defense Systems, have also all been contracted to fortify the European border to keep people out. Usually poor black and brown migrants who are fleeing, they're not even migrants, they're basically refugees. They probably mostly qualify for asylum. And they're fleeing like death and destruction in the Middle East and North Africa. And so Israeli technology that restricts the movement of Palestinians is being used to basically reinforce Fortress Europe, and I guess what you could call Fortress America. And in a lot of ways, you could look at that as a way of sort of assisting with this rise of border apartheid that we see creeping up across the world. It's very alarming and disturbing. And one thing I find really, really disturbing in the case of Europe, which I see happening increasingly, I mean, you've seen these migrant boats of hundreds of people, right, like dying at sea. And, you know, the far right in Europe has been experiencing a resurgence. And a lot of far-right politicians in Europe, a lot of them which have, you know, deep roots in anti-Semitism, like their parties do, are actually using the idea of protecting the Jews and the idea of the Holocaust to legitimize keeping migrants out, because these migrants are mostly Muslim, right? And, you know, in the idea of the far-right mind, Muslims hate Jews and Muslims are bad for Jews. So it's like this weird thing you see happening in Europe where these far-right politicians are invoking the Holocaust. Of all things, I mean, the Holocaust, a time when Jewish refugees on boats were being denied entry in places like the US and Canada. They're using this to legitimize denying boats of refugees refuge in Europe. I mean, it's really sickening and kind of reaches a new level of disturbing. But moving on from drones, I mean, Israel also invented targeted killings. So it's not just weapons and border technology. In this sense, it's tactics as well, because we see this having been adopted by the Obama administration. Weirdly, the Bush administration used to condemn Israel, like very vigorously condemn Israel for targeted killings against Palestinian leaders during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. Now, this is not the case with Obama. Obama has really embraced targeted killings as a centerpiece of his counterterrorism policy. And he's, because of that, he's killed hundreds to thousands in Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Somalia. Now, what does this have to do with Israel? Well, back in almost 4 years ago now, the U.S. government extrajudicially murdered an American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. Now, Obama has insisted that al-Awlaki was this like terrorist mastermind who was really bad and we had to take him out, like no other choice. But this guy, al-Awlaki, was never charged with a crime, and the White House refused to disclose the legal reasoning behind killing him. Luckily, there was this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit by the New York Times and the ACLU that forced the administration to release a redacted version of the DOJ memo, which outlines the Obama administration's rationale for killing American citizens abroad without trial. And what that kill memo said, which by the way was authored by a man named David Barron, who Obama appointed to a federal judgeship, so he gets to be a judge for life now. But so this kill memo, as they call it, basically cited a 2006 Israeli Supreme Court decision to justify killing Anwar al-Awlaki without a trial. And in that decision, Israel's high court ruled that the targeted assassination of hundreds of Palestinians since the start of the Second Intifada was legal and didn't violate international law. And so this provides the, like provided in this kill memo, the basis for why it's okay to kill American citizens abroad. In many ways, it really shouldn't come as a surprise that the U.S. is echoing Israeli rationale for validating its own belligerence in the war on terror. Because in a lot of ways, the war on terror bears this striking resemblance to what Israel's done to Palestinians, this war on Palestinians that Israel's been involved in for decades, and this war on its neighbors. And Israel, I mean, a part of what Israel does is it tries to constantly shift the goalposts for what is acceptable within the framework of international law. And it's generally successful at this. That's what it did with targeted killings. And this was basically admitted by this man named Daniel Reisner, who was the former head of the Israeli Army's International Law Division. In 2009, Daniel Reisner said the following. He said, "International law progresses through violations. We invented the targeted assassination thesis and we had to push it. At first, there were protrusions that made it hard to insert easily into the legal molds. 8 years later, it is at the center of the bounds of legitimacy." I mean, that's basically how Israel operates in the international elite arena. It does these awful, horrific things, but then, it has this massive international law division that shifts the goalpost and is constantly, weakening international law. And the U.S. does that as well. It's like sort of a back and forth. It's a synergy between the U.S. and Israel that are constantly weakening international law and the protections that exist for civilians to basically legitimize the awful things that they're doing. I mean, sadly, he's right. Like, Israel's assassinations in Gaza are so routine now that barely anyone bats an eye or even notices at this point, because unless Gaza's being carpet bombed, it's not news. But yeah, it's like the same thing is true for these drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan. Which have killed up to 4 Americans now. But, I mean, everyone else matters as well. It's killed thousands of people who aren't American. So what began as this Israeli method to suppress Palestinian resistance is now being used to kill people, in several countries. And, it's not just with targeted killings. I mean, the CIA, in this 100-page long Senate report that came out on the CIA's network of torture dungeons around the world. In that, the CIA several times cited Israeli court rulings to justify its post 9/11 worldwide network of torture dungeons. So, it's really striking. I mean, Israel, the U.S. is constantly looking at Israel for, especially with the war on terror, for ways to do things to people, and it's very disturbing. But the point of all this is that going back to Israel, why Israel is like this, as long as Israel's economy is shaped by the subjugation and warehousing of Palestinians, it's going to continue to function as this factory for cutting-edge repression technology. And it's going to continue to be a leader in what Israeli activist Jeff Halper calls the global pacification industry. And what that does is it's going to continue to contribute and reinforce this kind of racism and inequality and white supremacy around the globe. And so that's why dismantling Zionism, dismantling settler colonialism in Israel-Palestine is a necessary endeavor for all equality-minded, you know, anti-racist individuals and I believe groups in this country. The battle for justice in Palestine is a global struggle. What Israel does to Palestinians in many, many ways is kind of a glimpse into the future of what's to come for the most vulnerable and marginalized among us, the most disposable among us. And the situation for Palestinians right now is more urgent than I think it's ever been. The Israeli government is increasingly right-wing, increasingly has fascist tendencies. You know, if you just like look at the people in the latest Israeli government, you know, Netanyahu sort of occupies the center of Israeli politics, which is frightening, right? You know, people to his right are his justice minister, is Ayelet Shaked. She said last summer, she which is something that the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima should, you know, get credit for popularizing. But yeah, last summer, I mean, she endorsed this call to genocide of Palestinians, saying that their, you know, Palestinian mothers need to be slaughtered in their beds to prevent them from birthing little snakes. I mean, this is a language of genocide. And these are the people, this woman is the justice minister, the man who's in charge of the education department, of the education minister, Naftali Bennett. Someone who Ali Abu Nima, I have to say him again, because he always has the best, most clever remarks, but calls the incitement minister. This man brags about killing Arabs. Last summer, as Gaza was being bombed, he went on CNN and told Wolf Blitzer that Palestinian fighters in Gaza were committing massive self-genocide.
Yeah.
These are the people that are running the Israeli government, and it's very disturbing because of what, you know, the potential of what they could do to Palestinians, right? And the fact that even though they're in charge, we've seen, you know, what's been the response from the Obama administration so far? Well, it's been to, aside from some, you know, some rhetoric that's been a little bit more hostile to Netanyahu, it's been to approve this massive weapons deal. It's like a gift to the new incoming racist government. $1.9 billion weapons deal, thousands of Hellfire missiles and bunker buster bombs to replenish Israel's stockpile for the next round in Gaza. The situation for Palestinians is more urgent than ever right now. And I mean, Palestine continues to be erased. And the death merchants responsible in this weird laboratory, this military-industrial system that exists in Israel continue to profit. So, I mean, the question really becomes, how much more of Palestinian land will Israel get to take? And how many more Palestinians will Israel get to kill before the world says enough? I know that sounds really daunting and, you know, cynical to put it that way, to think about how you stop this massive machine, but I don't think it's impossible. I think part of the answer lies in recognizing that, like I said earlier, because the oppressors are working together, the oppressed need to work together. And that's what I see happening. I see that happening around the country, especially like with the anti-police brutality movement and Black Lives Matter, coming together with Palestinians and really making connections. There was a delegation of people that the Dream Defenders took to Palestine earlier in the year. And they were some of the people who were involved in the Ferguson uprising. And that was really awesome. Like, they went there, they made connections, they saw what was happening. I mean, they really do see these struggles so interconnected, and that's so, so incredibly important because that makes it more powerful. And also, what we see on college campuses around the country, too, with these SJP movements. I mean, they're really up there, but they do deserve an applause. I don't know if any of them are here. I mean, they're incredible. And they've been passing, you know, they've been putting forth these BDS resolutions under massive pressure from people with lots of money who are trying to like constantly slander them and like sue them and smear them and ruin their reputations. Despite that, they're still moving forward, and it's really become, I mean, a lot of ways, this like anti-militarization movement, because what they're trying to divest from, I mean, it's companies that are involved in the occupation in Palestine, but they also, you know, intersect. They're also companies that are involved in military ventures of the U.S. abroad. They're also companies that are involved in private prisons in this country. There are also companies that are involved at the U.S.-Mexico border and militarizing that. So it's really become this anti-racist, anti-militarization movement. And I think that's really powerful. And you've got like this broad array of students that are involved in this and people that are involved in this, from like Chicano students, Latino students, to You know, the black student unions are very heavily involved in a lot of the BDS work at universities. Lots of Jewish students are some of the leaders at the SJPs. So, I mean, it's really incredible and stuff to be inspired by. And I think that points in a really great direction for sort of like where the answer lies and how to solve this issue and how to deal with this issue. But I guess I'd want the most important thing for everyone here to take away from my talk, at least, is that everyone, especially all of us here, I think, have a stake in dismantling this system that contributes to so much repression around the world.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.